supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. At age 13, Christina Wanzelak was a beautiful girl, a good student, a promising swimmer. A few years later, she was living on the streets, eating out of trash cans, almost died because of her alcohol and drug addictions. What happened during those nightmarish years? How did she get there so quickly? How was her family affected? Well, together with her mother, Constance Curry, Christina tells her story and her mother's story in a new book called The Lost Years. Welcome to the show, Constance, Christina. Christina, let's start with you. Do we have you? No, Constance. Do we have you? Constance? Yeah, Constance.
Yes.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Sure, I'm thrilled to hear your voice after about 5 seconds of dead air. You don't know how happy that makes me.
Okay.
Your book was wonderful.
Well, thank you. It was quite a process to get here.
Well, I want you. You're not kidding. Let's begin at the beginning. The book opens up with what looks like an idyllic family: one brother,
right,
two sisters. Father's a good provider. You were a stay-at-home mom. You doted on your children. It sounds like, you know, what Garrison Keillor describes in Lake Wobegon: everyone's good-looking and above average. And your husband may have liked drinking a bit too much, but still looked like a pretty good family. Is that a fair description?
That's a fair description, yes, absolutely.
And that's how you saw it through your eyes back then. Now, let's jump ahead to your eyes now. And when you look back on that family back then, how would you describe it?
Well, I see a great deal of dysfunction, actually. I see two sides of a coin. On one side, we have so many blessings and good things happening and, you know, family vacations and so on. On the other side, there's a darker side where we have fear. We were walking on eggshells much of the time. And I would say our family was fear-based.
Fear-based.
Yes, and I think that Christina spoke to that. She was our sickest member, I suppose, at that point, or the one that was pointing to the dysfunction.
Did you know back then that you were living in fear?
No, I didn't. Well, certainly I would feel the fear, but I didn't realize how it was affecting everyone else in the family. You know, I was feeling fear. I knew that my children were. Oftentimes, I would try at night. I would try to overcome whatever happened in the daytime to fix it. You know, I was always trying to fix things.
Like,
you know what? I mean?
What kinds of things?
Oh, let's say we're having dinner and something is brought up at the dinner table, and one member of the family is really focused on as you know, not succeeding in whatever the task was, or
so you tried to keep calm.
That was my job, was to keep everybody happy and calm,
which is
collected.
Not an unusual job, but do you know what you were afraid of back then? Or were you just an anxious woman?
I think I was afraid of my husband when he was drinking. It was certainly we didn't know ever what was happening. It was like walking on eggshells. One day you'd say something and it would pass, and the next day you'd say something and it would cause anxiety or anger on his part. So it was a fear-based relationship my husband and I had, and that filtered down to the children.
So let me turn to you, Christine, and welcome to the show, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Your book opens up with your being 13 years old and taking your first drink. You described that moment in the basement with the vodka in such vivid detail, it sounded almost as though you were an out-of-control alcoholic before you took that first drink.
That's an interesting thought, and I agree in some ways. I mean, I really think that I was alcoholic from the start, from my first drink. You know, I loved what alcohol did for me, and it changed my life. And
how so? What did you love?
How so? From the first time I took that drink, I felt like I had found the solution. In some ways, it felt like it was the first time that I ever exhaled. It warmed me, it filled me, it made me feel safe and comfortable and alive. You know, I was very shy, and I didn't feel shy anymore. I was very insecure. I hated the way I sounded when I spoke. I hated the way I walked. I hated the way I looked. And when I drank, it was like all of that went away.
Now, I wonder if it's a coincidence that it happened at age 13, right when you were in puberty. Your body was changing. Your relationship with the world changes when you, girls in general, hit puberty.
It certainly was a challenging time in the sense that, you're right, I was beginning to notice that I was being noticed, and, you know, boys kind of enter the picture, and you start listening to music and thinking about other things, and sure, it was certainly an uncomfortable time, and alcohol relieved that for me.
So, in effect, you told us just now about your internal life before you took that first drink.
Mm-hmm.
You said you felt alive when you took the first drink, so there had to be a part of you that felt dead,
mm-hmm.
anxious, insecure, so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Constance, can you tell us about your internal life back then?
I felt often like I was living in a glass box, like I could see the world going around me, I could see my family around me, but I couldn't touch them, I couldn't get out of the box, and they couldn't get in. I often felt this glass box feeling.
Is that a lifetime experience?
No, I don't have that now, but I had that then. I don't have it now.
Did you have it when you were a child?
Not that I recall.
Hmm.
No.
Let me take a minute and reintroduce you. We're talking to Christine Wanzelak and her mother, Constance Curry. Together they have written The Lost Years. It describes how they've both grown and evolved through Christina's alcoholism. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I wonder, Christine, I'll turn this to you. Who decided the structure of the book?
Oh, good question. I did. I began writing the book. You know, I was a year sober when I said to my mom, you know, Mom, we should write a book about this extraordinary experience that we have survived. And she said, you know, Christy, that's a great idea, and you should do that. But, you know, a decade passed, and it came to me more and more that that this book had to be written, that I wanted to put this on paper. And the more that I worked with families and the more that I was working with alcoholism, the more I realized what a valuable story this would be. And so I began to put it on paper, and the more I wrote my story on paper, the more and more it came to me that in order to tell the whole story, I mean, there are a gazillion memoirs on addiction, but to tell the whole story of addiction, that it made sense to have the parent piece in there, to have my mom's story in there. My mom truly is, in my opinion, the backbone of this story in any case.
I mean, well, it's interesting. Not only did both of you tell your story, but the structure I thought was interesting, that you would begin, Christina, talking about an event in your life, and then, Constance, you'd come in and talk about how you experienced that moment, and that's how you wove the book together. I thought it was quite compelling.
Thank you. Thank you.
I want to come back to your body changing, Christine, at age 13. Your father began to get quite seductive with you. Tell us what happened.
Well, I think when he drank, he was just very inappropriate with me and with himself and, you know, with my mom. He was just, you know, when he drank, he became very inappropriate and he would comment on my body. And it was just a really uncomfortable thing for me to be looked at that way from him.
You used that word, uncomfortable. Were you ever afraid?
Was I ever afraid? I think uncomfortable is a better word, and I think in some ways, you know, I was listening to my mom talk about my dad's drinking, and I really believe that the tragedy of the alcoholic home for me was that I was raised in this environment that fostered insecurity, and my dad's drinking and talking about my body that way, that you know, encouraged that insecurity. I was very uncomfortable, and I was afraid to be seen. I was afraid for my body to be seen, so that was certainly a challenge. And it was when he drank, you know, and when he didn't drink, he was, you know, really great. And I guess that was the confusing thing. And like I said, the tragedy of the alcoholic home. And I believe where my low self-esteem came from was that on the outside, our family looked so beautiful, but on the inside, it felt like something else. And so I was really confused. It was a confusing thing for me.
Well, you both know you're in the substance abuse, both of you are in the substance abuse field now, yes?
Yes. Yes, Christina, really more than I am.
Well,
I'm there by, by experience.
Well, substance abuse is a complicated piece of business, and in your case, Christina, there's clearly a genetic component. But when you were young and going through it, like many alcoholics, you blamed your environment. You said there was pressure to be perfect, live up to mythical standards, and you lived in a family where there was denial going on, which contributed also. But when you look back on it, which was which? Does it even matter to you?
Do you mean?
Well, how much of your family's structure did in fact contribute? Your family's inability to talk, your family's pressure to look perfect on the outside?
It's a good question, and it doesn't matter, to answer your question. It doesn't matter to me today. What I know about addiction is, as you said, it is a very complicated issue, and there's a whole lot of different things that fold into the mix to create this recipe and this manifestation of this disorder. And so I don't blame my parents or my family for anything that happened to me. You know, if anything, you know, yes, my family had its dysfunction. I also never doubted that I was loved, and I believe that it was that got me into treatment at the age of 21 instead of dying or throwing myself off the Golden Gate Bridge, that somebody showed me enough love along the way, someone along the way showed me that I was worth saving at the age of 21, and I believe that came from my family as well. So, yes, we had our dysfunction. I also always knew that I was loved by both my parents. You know, even though my father was alcoholic and was inappropriate when he drank, he also quit drinking, you know, many, many years ago. And, you know, my mom, of course, really rallied to try and save me, help me, get me out of this to the best of her ability. So it doesn't matter to me anymore, you know, why this happened to me or what caused my alcoholism. It just doesn't matter anymore to me.
You know, I have to tell you, everyone I have spoken with who's recovered from addiction or some kind of significant childhood trauma says the same exact thing you just did. They say, when I needed it, there was someone outside of me that believed in me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that, and that got me through. And in your case, it was your family. Tell us, we're going to have to take a break in just a minute, but tell us, we left off the story when you were 13 and just beginning to drink a good deal. Tell us about Ben.
Well, I, you know, started drinking when I was 13 outside my window at night. And again, you know, I loved what alcohol did for me, and I drank as often as I could at night, lived a very duplicitous life in the fact that I still went to school and mass and, you know, was home on time and did everything a 13-year-old girl does. And then I went to high school and I was introduced to boys, and and to drugs. And I was introduced to drugs on my first date with this young person named Ben. And he was my, you know, a person that I dated for, well, I don't know if dated's the right word, but a person I was with for quite a few years. And, you know, I don't blame him for anything. I was saying this just the other day at a book signing. I don't blame him at all for anything that happened to me. If it hadn't have been Ben, it would have been Jack or Jacob or Jill or anyone else down the line. As you said, Dr. Gottlieb, you know, I believe, like an addict waiting to happen. So in some ways, I feel that Ben got tied up in my addiction, not the other way around.
Was this simply an addictive relationship, or was there substance between you and Ben? Were there genuine human feelings?
Oh, absolutely. I believe so. I mean, looking back, you know, now that I'm, you know, 35 years old with 13 and a half years sobriety and a college, you know, education behind me and all these other things and a deeper understanding of what happened to me in addiction, sure, I mean, I'm sure it would be classified today as your classic love addiction, you know, out of control relationship. But back then, yeah, I mean, I thought the sun, you know, rose and set in him. I was crazy about him. I was crazy about him in a way that I could barely see outside myself. And then you added chemicals in the mix, and it was just a disaster waiting to happen. And I have, you know, very deep regret, because I know he loved me the best he could also. And I think, like I said, we were both drug addicts, and we harmed each other and ourselves a great deal in that relationship. But I don't blame him for anything that happened to me.
Constance.
Yes.
You there? When Christina was, at the time, this addicted to Ben and cocaine and alcohol, she was sneaking out of the house in the middle of the night. She looked terrible. Her grades were going down. She got thrown off her beloved swimming team. When did you realize she was out of control, and what did you do?
Well, finally, I started calling treatment centers and a therapist in the area asking for help.
It's almost as though she forced you out of your denial.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would whisper, do you think that this could be drug behavior? You know, I was afraid to say that outright, so I had to ask for help. And that's when I started to make progress in understanding her behavior and realizing that I had no power around her behavior. But it was a long process difficult.
Where was your husband on this? What was happening in your marriage?
Well, oftentimes we worked well together when we were trying to help Christina, because we had this common cause. Sometimes I felt sabotaged by him in the things I was trying to do. For example, sending her to treatment was something I had to really fight for initially. But he would follow through, you know, so I had to take the lead. And I didn't necessarily take the lead in other things in our relationship, but eventually that was my job. I had to take over that part of it. And he would support me after the work was done. So,
all right. Let's take a short break here. I want to come back and I want to hear what happened as things spun even further out of control. What happened to Christina and Constance, how you coped with it. My guests are Christina Wanzelak and Constance Curry. Christina describes her life from age 13 through 21 in the book The Lost Years, how she spun out of control with alcohol and cocaine. Constance is her mother. She describes how her life spun out of control, and what evolved from that is nothing less than wonderful to hear about and read about. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, it's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices from the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
This week on NPR's Justice Talking, organized crime in America. The Italian mafia has been decimated in part due to laws designed to break up the mob. Those same laws are now being used to prosecute street gangs around the country and other ethnic crime groups. We'll also hear how the FBI is fighting a more sophisticated mob and the story of two New York City cops who murdered for the mob. This week on NPR's Justice Talking. Tonight at 10 on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. My guests are Christina Wonzelak and her mother, Constance Curry. They've described their lives in the book, The Lost Year, their lives when Christina was age 13 through 21, when her life spiraled out of control for the next 8 years or so, and it describes both of their evolution. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. So, Christina, as the story unfolds, there was one point where you did acknowledge to yourself that your husband was an alcoholic. So here you have a daughter who was out of control. You realize you're the spouse of an alcoholic. What was happening with you internally then? You had worked so hard to keep all your anxiety at arm's length.
Right. Well, I just started going to 12-step meetings. I went to 3 and 4 of those a week. I reached out to some women in the community. So I really asked for help. I started going to therapy, which I had never done before. So I just started to realize what was... And at one point, I'm sitting in one of these 12-step meetings, and I realized that it was not about Christina, that I just didn't have power there. It was about my marriage and myself, and that's when I really started to realize how I needed to work on myself and get better myself.
So let me stop you there and ask you to clarify a bit. I can hear a lot of listeners saying, well, wait a minute, your daughter was an alcoholic. Why are you going to 12-step meetings?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I couldn't cope. I needed help to cope with and understand what was happening to her.
So you went to Al-Anon, which is for families and loved ones of substance abusers.
Absolutely. And I'd resisted for quite a while, of course, when people would suggest maybe you should go to Al-Anon. I would resist. But at some point, I realized I couldn't do this by myself. I was feeling more and more isolated from my friends and family, and trying to cope with it all myself. It was just too much.
You know, what's interesting to me, Constance, is, you know, when we started, the way you described your home, your family life, is almost idyllic. I didn't envision you as the kind of person that would be open enough to reach out for help.
Well, you reach a bottom where you're really lonely and just realize that I wanted to help my daughter. I just was so bewildered by what was happening. And I initially, of course, didn't see the connection between my husband's drinking and my passivity. I really gave my power away one day at a time in my marriage. And so by this time that Christina started acting out, I'd lost a lot of what my core person was. So I needed help to find that again, and I found in Al-Anon a great support. And, you know, all you do is go to a meeting, and if you can just barely say your name, somebody's going to come mm-hmm. and offer comfort or, you know, assistance in some way. And so I found it very comforting, and 4 days a week I ended up going to Al-Anon meetings for several years when Christy was acting out as, you know, in the depth of her addiction, and finally, through that, I realized that I was the only person I could help. I couldn't change my husband. I couldn't change my daughter. I could only change myself. So that's when I started walking, going to meetings and walking and talking to myself along the way. Hmm. Somehow came through it.
Christina.
Yes.
Your first, around this time, when your mother's her life was falling apart, when your life was falling apart. The story of your first involuntary hospitalization, you were, what, 14, 15, so your mother could get you in against your will. But the story was amazing. It sounded like a CIA prison they took you to.
Yeah, you know what's interesting, Doctor, about my mom's story and finding Al-Anon is just from my, what I love about the book is that it really tells a story from, you know, the both different sides. And, you know, the truth is that I remember before my mom found Al-Anon how spineless I thought she was and how weak she was. And when she found Al-Anon, I remember thinking, Al-Anon has ruined my life. Because my mom started getting stronger and stronger and setting these boundaries, and then they put me in this first, my first treatment center, and it felt kind of like a CIA.
only much less security, obviously.
Yeah, it was, sure, I mean, and that's, you know, that's adolescent treatment, and, you know, that's where they took me, and that they could hold me against my will, and it was a really scary, scary time for me.
Tell us about the content of that center. I want to hear about the content only because I thought it was so anti-therapeutic.
The content, you know, I can't really speak much to the content because I wasn't there very long, but, you know, looking back, I can say that I think the people there were really kind, at least they tried to be, you know, and the other clients in the treatment center. This is the amazing thing about it, even though I was only there like 4 days, if that.
Before you ran away.
Exactly, before I planned my escape. You know, the amazing thing about treatment is that it's effective in the sense that even though I was there for those that short amount of time, you know what it did? It ruined my drinking and using. I mean, it set into motion a whole nother avenue in my life that I never expected, because the truth is I just figured, you know, I was going to live and die like a drug addict. And when they put me in this treatment center, even though I wanted nothing to do with it, what I knew about that place was that there was help for somebody like me. And therefore, maybe I had some choice in what was happening to me. It was a bizarre thing. It ruined my drinking and using for the rest. I tell clients that today. I had maybe 1 year of good drug use before, or guilt-free drug use before, you know, it was ruined by this treatment center. And so I don't really remember much about it. I know I went to, you know, meetings, and the other kids there were, you know, cool, I guess, and relatively nice, but I tried not to notice, and I tried not to connect with anybody because I knew I was going to escape, and, you know, that human connection made it harder to leave. So really my purpose there was just to figure out how I was going to get out of there.
So you got out, you ran away, you wound up getting placed back in there again, and you ran away again, and then your life began to spin really out of control. Tell us what happened.
Well, it was just a terrible time of, like you said, being placed in a center, and then I would run, and they would capture me and put me back, and then I would run, and then, you know, the third time, you know, I was a runaway for quite a while, just doing whatever I had to do to survive, but eventually, you know, my parents did try one more time to put me in a center, and this time they put me in a center out of state, and in the middle of nowhere, really. And they drove me, you know, nonstop. I think it was 18 hours. We went nonstop from one place, you know, from California to another, and they put me in this place and drove away.
What was that like? What was that like for you when you were in that car? I'm wondering if you felt terrified, out of control, if you felt loved, if you felt a sense of your parents' devotion.
You know, it was like this tornado of emotion. I was so angry at them for making me the problem, for driving me to this place, thinking that that was going to fix this whole family. I mean, that's what my anger really towards my mom was, that I can't believe that you think me being here is going to make you happy. So I was angry. I was enraged. I was really sad. I was terrified. I was terrified of what was happening to me, that my life was out of control. I was terrified, even in my quietest of moments, I was terrified that they might be right and that I might need this place. I was afraid that my life was going to change. I was afraid that Ben would leave me. I was afraid that I would lose everything in my life that meant anything to me. I was... and all those things.
And, you know, you were afraid they were right, and at the same time, and they were, and you were right also, that your getting sober was not going to make your mother happy or change the family. So in some respects, you were both right.
Which I think in some ways is the agony of it all. That I mean, that's one of the things I learned through writing The Lost Years, was that we were both right on a lot of things, a lot of the time. And somehow we just kind of missed in the middle of the night. We just kind of kept ramming into each other. But the truth is, in some ways, we all wanted the same thing. We just didn't know how to get there. And there was this crazy addiction in me. For whatever reason, all the family stuff and all the systemic stuff behind it, there came a time that I was an addict through and through, and it no longer mattered what happened to get me there or what was going to happen in the future. I had to recover from it.
Christina, while all of this was going on, obviously you were, Constance, while all of this is going on, you obviously never gave up on Christina, but during the early stages, you were taking her back in the house over and over again and negotiating with her.
Absolutely. We tried, and I think parents need to go through that process. You can't go to a child that's acting out and all of a sudden put them in a treatment center. You have to try everything you can think of and things you haven't ever thought of before you're willing to admit that your child needs help that you can't provide for them. And I want to say about that treatment center, it was connected to our community hospital, the first one that she went to. So it was in our community and certainly, you know, well-credentialed but maybe a little more clinical, because remember, this is 20 years ago. Mm. This is not today. So back then, there were very few options for us. And then the third one was in Idaho, and it was a woman's facility and in the wilderness, basically. So I've forgotten your question.
Christina, the facility you described, I don't want to spend too much time talking about the facility, but it sounded stark and punitive. When you look back in hindsight, back then, what did you need? What would have been helpful?
Well, that's a good question.
What would have been helpful? Certainly,
that's a really good question.
There's a lot of families out there waiting, you know, and wondering. Go on.
Well, I was going to say that I'm not sure that she didn't have to go through the whole process before anything was going to matter. Would you say that, Christina?
Yeah, I don't know. I was really stubborn and very angry. I guess, you know, maybe it would have made a difference if, and I try to do this in my work today, you know, I would say that the way I could answer that is how I fashion my intervention work today is really to take the time to find that human connection with me instead of being treated as just like another drug addict in this treatment center and everything I said or everything I did was a lie or a denial or this or that or, you know, manipulative. Maybe if someone had just sat with me.
Less punitive.
And, you know, kind of the heart-to-heart connection, which is what I do in my work today. Really try to make that connection. I'm not sure if I would have stayed sober, to be honest with you, because I had to go through what I had to go through. But
that's a different question. I mean, my question was, what did you need? Not what would have kept you sober, you know? I mean, maybe nothing would have kept you sober,
right.
But I guess I'm listening through the ears of, you know, all my listeners or some of the listeners who wonder, you know, what would I do in that situation or what should I do now? I'm hearing another factor from both of you, and that's the family. And I wonder how you would have reacted, Christina, if your mom said, look, you're sick, I'm sick. The whole family's sick. All of us are going to go get help.
That would have been...
We did try that a little bit, but you have to have everybody on board in order to have that happen. To have total family therapy, everyone has to be willing to go and participate. And so what happened then was that each several times we did go as family to therapy, and it was so interesting. I would think, okay, we're going to go because Christina has this problem or my husband has this problem. And what would happen in therapy would be that I would be the one that would be the subject of the anger and the, you know, the, I would be the one in the middle. And I never quite understood that, but it, but we didn't get to go any further than that. Several times we went, but we didn't get to go any further. So there wasn't really a choice in our family to do family therapy because not everybody was on board. It had to come from me. I had to get better, and the rest of them would follow, hopefully.
Christine, go on.
Yes. Well, I was just going to say, the truth is, that is what happened. You know, when I escaped from Idaho and I came home, you know, to my parents' home, my mom came to the door and said, you know, there's a very poignant part in this book, I think, where my life changed forever. And it was when my mom came to the door and said, I love you. You know, I am so glad that you are alive, but you are not welcome in my home or in my life until you are living a life of recovery, you know. And if I never see you alive again, I want you to know how much you are loved.
I want to hear about what that was like for you, Christina, that moment, and for you, Constance. We'll start with Christina.
That was, like I said, it changed my life forever. But you know what it did for me, Dr. Gottlieb? It showed me that this wasn't just about, just like you said, that it was no longer just about me, that this was about my family. And what my mom was saying to me was that I'm not living with addiction anymore, right? You may not be ready to get help. I get it. Right, I have sent you all over this country to try and get you help. You may not be ready, but I am. You may not see that there's a problem, but I do. And I'm going to get better. So what it did for me, first of all, I thought she was just having a high self-esteem day, you know, and she'd get over it. But she didn't for 3 years. I mean, she never got over it. So I felt I felt enraged. You know, who was she to do this to me? I felt stubborn, like I was going to show her, I was going to head out into the world and show her that I could make it on my own and show her that, you know, I was going to be just fine without her. And in some ways, if I'm really honest, in those quiet times, I felt relief because I no longer had to carry the weight of her on me. You know, that was the thing about my family, is they put pressure on me. Not only did I have to figure out my own life, but I had the pressure of five other people to make happy or to make contented, and my choices seem to affect them. In some ways, I felt relief, like, oh, it's over.
And you,
now I can just fall apart or do what I want.
You know, your story is not just your story, that always the identified patient, the one with the symptoms in a family like yours, is always the one that feels like they're carrying the family on their shoulder. Of course, your mother was feeling the same thing, and who knows, one of your sibs might have been feeling the same thing at the same time.
Probably several of them.
Right, right. I want to come back to that moment with you when you uttered those words to Christina. And I want to make sure our listeners know this is more than just saying a sentence to your daughter. There was a whole lot behind that sentence.
Well, what I felt was, at that point, I knew I couldn't help her anymore. I had come to that realization. It was almost like hitting bottom. I just realized, I'm helpless here, and I can only take care of myself. So what I feel, treatment was always an option for her, even though I told her she couldn't come into the house, she couldn't be a part of our family at this point. She could always go to treatment. That was there. She knew where it was. She knew the phone number. And I felt like, you know, I had to take charge of myself, and I realized I could not get better myself while I was dealing with her. It was too unsettling, too disruptive, too all-encompassing. So I had to remove her and remove myself from this whole synergism that was going on.
Well,
and so it was so fearful. Oh, my goodness.
I was going to say, what you're saying sounds clear and simple and easy, but you're saying that you actually made a choice of yourself over your daughter.
Well, I was hoping, you know, I didn't do this by myself. I had therapists that were telling me that, that I needed to let her go. And so that was how I saw it, that I was letting her go, letting her make her choices, and I would make mine. I didn't know what else to do. I tried everything else I could think of, and nothing was happening. So, and it was very painful to watch her in this downward spiral. And I had other children to consider, not just myself. I had three other children, two of them younger than Christina, still in grade school and high school. So I couldn't put my whole focus on her and her addiction. So that's what the choice that I made.
So,
and
so behind that statement is a great deal of support, insight, reflection, and it sounds like that statement is right on the cusp between terror and helplessness and enormous courage.
Well, I don't know which one it is you can choose.
All of the above.
All of the above, I suppose.
And you know, I really see it, and I want to be really clear that even as that door closed on me, actually, literally and figuratively, I never doubted, or I always knew, that my mom loved me. And what happened for me that day as that door closed on me was I realized that she was getting better. I can't explain. It was like, you know, the difference between, and I tell families this all the time, between an empty threat and a boundary, right? The threat comes from trying to get me to do something. The boundary came, her boundary came from this incredible self-care that she had come to have for herself. And she was so clear at that door. It was just so clear that she wasn't choosing. She wasn't letting her daughter go. She was letting go of addiction, that she was no longer going to have addiction affect her life and the life of my brothers and sisters. And that was very clear to me. I want you to know that. I knew. I mean, it wasn't, she didn't, it was so different than anything else I'd ever seen. She wasn't angry. She didn't raise her voice. It was very kind and tender and honest and real.
And it's also, so that's a whole lot goes into that one sentence, and at the same time, everything you said, and there's a role model for you. You're watching a role model. I think when any of us watch our parents, we see the potential for our future, both the good news and the bad news. I want to summarize the next step, because we have to take a short break, and I want to talk about how things did turn around. So you wound up living on the streets with horrific things happening to you, as would any young girl on the streets, with rape. There was a point where a man held a gun to your head and you begged him to pull the trigger, selling your body, and so on and so forth. And your mother's mantra, every time you called the house, was, are you ready for treatment? Are you ready for treatment? When we come back, I want to hear what happened to both of you when you finally said, yes, you were ready. We're talking to Christina Wanzelak and her mother, Constance Curry, who have written a book, The Lost Years. It describes their lives over 8 years, when Christina was 13 through 21, when her life spiraled out of control, and so did her mother's. It describes their downhill spiral, their uphill recovery, and it's a wonderful, poignant story. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
On the next Fresh Air, Alex Kapranos, frontman for the indie rock quartet from Glasgow, Franz Ferdinand. Kapranos has a new book about eating on tour. It's called Sound Bites. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day.
The town of New England, North Dakota is starving for a new supermarket.
The last one closed 2 years ago.
But they're refusing to become another rural American ghost town. Residents are trying something new.
Can't take it down yet, man.
They're building their own grocery.
It takes a village to raise a kid, and I think it's going to take a village to keep its soul.
Food for a town and its soul.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. We are talking about The Lost Years, the name of a book that has been written by Christina Wanzelak and Constant Curry, mother and daughter. Christina's life was out of control. Both their lives were out of control when Christina was using drugs and alcohol. I want to come back to that moment when Christina was living on the streets. You knew she was living on the streets, Constance, and you kept asking her, are you ready for treatment? What happened? Let's start with you, Christina. What was going on with you when you finally said yes?
Oh, gosh, I had, you know, I ended up on the floor of a homeless shelter as the book opens up, you know, on the floor of this homeless shelter in the bathroom, and I thought I was dying. And for me, it was this poignant moment of clarity that, you know, that I was going to die, you know, that I could disappear off the face of this earth and nobody would know. And, you know, that I had planned on being so much more than this at the age of 21, and I knew that if I could make it off this floor, I'd do whatever I had to change my life. And the thing about the gift that my mom gave me by letting me go and having my choices was on the floor of this shelter, I realized that it was no longer about, you know, proving them wrong or getting them to love me or getting them to give me money or anything. It was just, no one was coming to save me, or it just was really up to me. It was just about me, and if I wanted to change my life, I was going to have to do it, and it was no longer about being angry or anything else. So, you know, when I crawled out of that bathroom and called my mom, and she said again, you know, are you calling for treatment? I'm not exactly sure where it came from, but maybe it was divine intervention, but I was absolutely ready, and I was ready.
And Constance, tell us what happened then.
Well, I didn't quite trust because there had been so many trials and errors, but I did make sure that the treatment center would be ready for her, and she went. She found her own way there. I didn't take her. And so that began our recovery. And after several weeks, I started going to the family meetings and took my other children there as well.
What happened to your husband in this process?
At that point, we were not together. So he was not involved at that point. He did actually participate in paying for this treatment center, but he was not involved at that point in our family. So it was kind of my thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I was really grateful that she went, and I embraced this treatment center, and the people there were kind and loving and supportive, and, you know, we participated in all the family education and the family circle, which was certainly very painful, but beneficial to my whole family, and that's when our family really got help. The whole family finally got help at that point.
We didn't talk at all about your other children, and except just now, when you brought them to the treatment center, what were they going through with all this, and were you able to protect them?
Well, actually, I think at that point we were all looking at our family in a new way and recognizing the dysfunctions that had happened in our family, and we were all on board to get better ourselves. My son was in college at that time, so he was not as active in participating as the girls were who were there and had no choice. I was taking them to Alateen, and so then when it came the opportunity to attend family meetings at the treatment center, we did attend those eventually and learn more about what happened in our family. And so it was painful for them, but we, you know, I was trying my best to keep their life normal. Hmm. And so I think as much as that was possible, we did that.
Christina, we know that the rehab you went to was not the whole story of treatment. Tell us what happened to you, what you did after rehab.
Oh, well, it was certainly a slow and cathartic time in my life, particularly my first year sober. Really the greatest achievement of my life is, you know, that first 365 days clean and sober, and I stayed in treatment for half a year, and it was a really important time in my life. Like my mom said, that particular treatment center, they were just so kind and loving to me, and it was probably exactly what it'd been a long time, let's say, that anyone had been kind and loving to me. And when I left treatment, I still, you know, I was very impaired. I was very broken, you know, living on the street and living that kind of life. I was very broken, and it's much harder. It's much harder than I thought it was going to be, making the transition from homelessness to acclimating back to a life of normalcy. It was much harder than I thought. So, you know, when I left treatment, I lived in a van for a while, which, you know, it was a really, actually, now that I have two kids and a husband and a practice, sometimes the van doesn't look so bad. You know, living in a van and surfing all day and just going to meetings doesn't sound so bad. But
let me just ask you briefly, because we're just about out of time. The book was pretty graphic. Some of the scenes of what you went through were pretty graphic. How did your husband and children react?
Oh, great question. My children are very young, so they don't. They don't read at this particular time. My husband, you know, can I tell you in very quickly, one of the greatest gifts of this book, you know, for the longest time, there was this really deep thought in me that if people really knew me, you know, that they wouldn't love me. Like, I know my husband vowed his life with me, but if he really knew my darkest days, he wouldn't love me. And he knew about my past, and, you know, we met when I lived in the van and all that, so he knew, but... You know, it's different when you see it on paper. And one of the greatest gifts is I let him read the I didn't let him read any of the book until I had it, 315 pages of a manuscript. I handed it to him and sent it to an agent in New York, both at the same time. And he read it in one sitting. And he came to me with tears, it was so sweet, running down his face. And he just said, you know, I love you. I mean, I love you. And one of the greatest gifts.
You were free. You were free of that fear. Unfortunately, we're just about out of time. And I want to thank both of you so much for your beautiful book and sharing the work you've done. My guests have been Christina Wanzlack and Constance Curry. Wanzlack and Curry are the authors of The Lost Year. Wanzlack's also an addiction interventionist at Full Circle Intervention. If you want to know more about it, you can visit her at www.fullcircle.com. Information about my upcoming lectures and activities are at drdangottlieb.com. If you want to reach us on the show, we're at voices@whyy.org. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Day to day.